Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We had a fantastically interesting webinar sponsored by the Committee on the Present Danger China Thursday of last week, in which three of our preeminent authorities came together to talk about the challenge of deterring the war that the Chinese Communist Party seems increasingly intent on taking from the unrestricted, non-kinetic kind that they've been engaged in for decades against us into a new and violent form, a very much kinetic kind of warfare. To discuss that issue, reprise a bit of the most important findings of this webinar, and recap some of his important contributions to it, I'm very pleased to have with us Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. In the course of a very distinguished career in naval intelligence, he rose through the ranks to become the Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And since he left his duty station there, has been continuing to contribute mightily through programs like ours of the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which I'm proud to say he is a member, to illuminate the kinds of problems, the threats that he saw coming and warned about during his time in uniform. Captain Fennell, welcome back to Securing America. It is always a red letter day when you are in the house, sir, virtually at least.
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be back. Appreciate your inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let me ask you about one of the most important takeaways of this webinar, Jim, I think, and that was that the buildup that the Chinese are engaged in the Western Pacific specifically, naval, missiles, aircraft, space, and the like, is now creating conditions under which they could have a decisive advantage over our own forces there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Frank, I mean, for the last 25 years, the People's Liberation Army across the various services, as you mentioned, especially in the naval, in the rocket forces and the air forces, that the Chinese Communist Party has been building them up for 25 years. And for most of that period, we in the West kind of just ignored it or dismissed it. Some even apologized for it and said, well, this is natural because they're a big country. But now they have the wherewithal to be able to exert military options that they didn't have before. For instance, in the South China Sea, if you go back to when I was in uniform, I retired 7 years ago, but when I was serving in the Western Pacific with the 7th Fleet or on the Kitty Hawk, you know, the United States Navy had the advantage of being the most predominant Navy that was operating inside that first island chain of the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And now here we are 20 years later, and China essentially is the dominant military force inside the first island chain, outnumbering the U.S. Navy probably on an average of 10 to 1 in the South China Sea on any given day. We operate there and do some large exercise with carrier strike groups, with our own, with expeditionary strike groups, with our allies like Japan. But then we do it for a week, and then we go home. And the Chinese are there. They built three major bases, naval bases, that they're the size of Pearl Harbor, and they're operating from these bases, ships, aircraft, and they have military equipment there to shoot long-range surface-to-surface missiles that can essentially control the entrance or the operations in the South China Sea. So we've seen a shift in the balance of power over the last 25 years where our presence has remained in the Western Pacific with the 7th Fleet roughly on the order of 60 to 70 ships, whereas China's gone from essentially no ships 25 years ago, no real blue water Navy ships, to over 350. And they're all concentrated in the Western Pacific. Our smaller Navy, large total Navy is around the world. So again, we're at a military disadvantage right now in naval, in air, in strategic rockets. They've built the cyber initiative with the Strategic Support Force. They're putting satellites 40 to 50 satellites in space every year. And those are all in some form or fashion, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, subordinate to the PLA and providing them, intelligence about the location of U.S. forces in the region.
Yes. Jim Fennell, we had, in addition to your good self, Stephen Mosier, the author of Bully of Asia, and Dr. Bradley Thayer, the author of several important books, including one about Han centrism and the sort of racist impetus behind a lot of China's ambitions. The three of you agreed not only that an attack by China seems now imminent, but that it might involve attacks against our own assets, perhaps personnel and, territory even. Talk us through that calculation, if you would, please, Jim.
Right. In the PLA's doctrine for conducting what they've talked about as a short, sharp war, while applied to the Senkakus, that's clearly the way they're thinking about taking Taiwan. And to do that, they know that they have what they call counter-intervention strategy, which is to keep the U.S. from being able to come to the aid of Taiwan. So the PLA wants to be able to strike quickly, like lightning, and get at Taiwan through a variety of means of air, naval, and rocket attacks, and then launch an invasion. And they want to be able to keep the U.S. forces at bay. Well, one way to do that is to attack our forces while they're in port in Japanese ports, whether it's in Yokosuka, with where our Seventh Fleet, majority of our Seventh Fleet ships are at, or down in Sasebo, where amphibious ships are at, or in Kadena, where our U.S. Air Force largely operates out of, or even in Misawa, up in close to Hokkaido. So it's very much in part of their strategy would be to attack our forces to prevent them from being able to come into the fight. And we know that's true, just even if you don't believe that. We had physical evidence. We saw in the deserts of central China in 2012, we saw mock-ups of Yokosuka Naval Base, where my ships, the ships that I served on, it had a mock-up of those ships and the outline of the port, the exact dimensions of Yokosuka Navy Base, and they were training their ballistic missiles to launch into space, turn on a sensor, and be able to find that and then attack it at supersonic speeds. So we know that this is what their plan would be. And there's a lot of people, though, that still try to say, oh, they wouldn't do that. They just try to keep it confined to Taiwan. But when, the Communist Party would prefer not to use military force like they did to take Scarborough Shoal in 2012 or to build these seven islands in the South China Sea. They did it all without firing a shot. And they'd like to be able to get Taiwan that way. But if it comes to the point where they say we can't get it any other way and we're on a timeline to get it, they're going to use all force and they're going to be all in and they're not going to risk taking an attack just on Taiwan and risking that the United States and our allies like the Quad could come in and disrupt it. They're not going to risk that when they finally decide to use military force. So we have to anticipate that we're going to be the brunt of that attack. They've also built DF-21D, DF-26, anti-ship ballistic missiles that are designed specifically to find our carriers and our big deck amphibs and to destroy them at sea from ranges from 1,000 to 2,000 miles from our coastline.
A clue of their intentions in that regard is they've also been building out those outlines of the carrier, vessels and their accompanying surface combatants. Very little is being left to the imagination here, and we fail to recognize it, let alone address it as we must at our extreme peril. We're going to talk more on the other side of a very short break with Captain James Fennell about specifically what it is we must be doing in the face of these very strong signs of an impending Chinese attack against us, as well as Taiwan. That and more, straight ahead.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The election of an erstwhile narco-terrorist leader to be Colombia's next president moves Latin America to the brink of being entirely run by this country's enemies. With the fall of Peru and Chile to communists last year and the prospect that Brazil's electorate may soon return to power, its former radical leader, Lula, an enduring ascendancy of indigenous Marxists, seems assured. Worse yet, external forces are at work there as well. The Chinese communists and their Russian and Iranian allies are aggressively expanding influence operations, infrastructure buildouts, and basing arrangements that will strengthen their footholds in the Western Hemisphere under the banner of today's Communist Internationale, known as the Forum of Sao Paulo. No good can come of all this for U.S. commercial or strategic interests, or the flow of still more illegal aliens fleeing leftist predations. Paging President Monroe. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. And I'm always pleased to be able to say welcome to our guest. We're continuing this really important conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, formerly one of the top intelligence officers in the U.S. Navy. He was the chief of intelligence specifically for the Pacific Fleet until he retired about 7 years ago. He continues his work at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in the Washington, D.C. area, but he is very active in helping the rest of us appreciate certain realities about the challenges that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party, specifically, increasingly, in the military domain. And Jim, I mentioned that you and Bradley Thayer and Stephen Mosier participated in a terrific program a week or so ago in which we talked about these threats now emerging and whether we're doing all that we can and must to deter them, notably to Taiwan, but also it is the consensus view of your experts to us as well. So I want to drill down a little bit more on what we must be doing now in light of the kinds of threats that you're talking about, Jim, and most especially, you know, what do we need to be doing to deter what the Chinese seem intent on doing to Taiwan if they feel they can get away with it?
Frank, time is not on our side. We are in what I have been calling for the last 10 years, the decade of concern between 2020 and 2030 that I anticipated that the People's Republic of China, the Communist Party, would make a decision internally to say the non-kinetic measures and pressures are not going to work and that they have to pull the trigger to use the military in order to force unification to then be able to have this grand ceremony in October 1st, 2049. So, and there's a lot more people saying that now, talking about 2027, 2025, even Admiral Aquilino, the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, this last week in an interview uttered the words decade of concern, which kind of floored me. Hadn't been talking about that for a long time. Anyway, the time is not on our side, so we have to take kind of immediate actions. And one of them is we don't have to necessarily come out and say anything about this policy of strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan. We just need to take actions. And the first action I would take is I would establish a combined command with the United States Indo-Pacific Command, some 3 or 4 star general or admiral from that command dispatched to Taiwan to work side by side with his counterparts from Taiwan and to include the Japanese and any other members of the Quad and other nations that would want to participate. But we need an operational command center in Taipei or wherever it is in the island of Taiwan to be able to do what we do, for instance, in the Korean Peninsula with Combined Forces Command, where Americans and South Koreans sit shoulder to shoulder with other United Nations members as well and operationally work together at not the strategic level, but at the operational and tactical levels of military operations to where our soldiers, sailors, and airmen and Marines can operate together in the field have common language, common command and control procedures, common strategies, defensive and offensive tactics, techniques, and procedures. That needs to be established in Taiwan. That's the first thing I would do. It doesn't cost anything except a couple of airplane tickets and political will. The other things that I would do is we've watched China build up and have what our U.S. Strategic Command commander, Admiral Richards, called in this last year, China, the People's Republic of China, has had a nuclear breakout with 350 ICBM silos being built in central and western China. So China is building what they believe will be a nuclear blackmail capability to use essentially in their conquest to take Taiwan. We need to seriously consider putting nuclear weapons in Taiwan to make sure that Taiwan or the PRC and the Chinese Communist Party understands that any effort to take Taiwan would essentially be their responsibility for ratcheting up a nuclear conflict. That needs to be done. Then we need to obviously increase our presence and operations in the region, but we can't do that with the force structure that we have today. So our Navy and our Air Force specifically, and most critically, are underfunded, they don't have enough resources, they don't have enough platforms. This administration submitted a budget that would take the U.S. Navy down from 297 ships to 280. Now, the Congress just stepped in and has countered and said, we won't decommission some number, a couple of dozen ships. So that may not exactly go down, but it's a reversal of the trend that Trump reversed from 20 years of previous decline of the U.S. Navy under previous Republican and Democrat, especially Obama, administration that drove the Navy down into the dirt. We need to reverse that, and that takes time.
These are some sweeping recommendations. We'll be talking more about the nuclear deterrent piece of this with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry later in the program. But just staying with this idea of not further diminishing our capabilities, the Navy, as you know, has its sight set on making changes in its force structure so as to afford other equipment that they need to build for the future. Are we able to simply hold on to the assets that we currently have, some of which are providing, air defense, by the way, for our carrier battle groups, which, as you've indicated, are very much in the crosshairs, literally, of the Chinese missiles, and therefore we're in need of those capabilities all the more. But as a practical matter, do we have the option, Jim, of keeping in place assets that we currently certainly need and will arguably even more in the future?
I think we have to consider that, because constructing them and trying to say we're going to build new ships between now and 2030, when the likelihood of a conflict is the highest, it's not going to work. I mean, I want to build a bigger Navy, but even if I gave them trillions of dollars today, we don't have the shipyards to be able to physically do it. So we have to take existing platforms, even commercial ships, and think creatively, think innovatively, and equip those ships to be able to operate in the region. The other thing we need to really do is, the Russian Navy isn't that much of a literal threat. It's a nuclear threat, and we have some assets that can watch those things. But we should be able to do what we said we were going to do in the Obama era, which was have a 60-40 split in the U.S. Navy. Maybe it should be a 70-30 split, where we take 70% of the Navy platforms and forward them out to the Western Pacific, because they're no good operating in Norfolk when the conflict starts in Taiwan. They need to be in the region.
Especially if the Panama Canal is in the Chinese hands, and transiting there is going to be very, very tricky indeed. Jim, we're almost out of time. I did just want to leave you with one thought. There's an argument being made that we need a commission to study what ails the United States Navy in order to get this fixed. This comes out of John Ferrari, I believe, at the American Enterprise Institute. Is that what's in order, or do we really know what ails the Navy and we just need to be about fixing it to have the kind of forward capability that we need at this moment?
We've been studying ourselves since the wall came down in 91, and we've lost our way. We knew what to do in the Reagan era in the Cold War, and it was to fight and win wars at sea. We know that's the task at hand, and we're not doing anything to do that. And another high-level blue ribbon commission in Washington, D.C., that will spend 2 or 3 years and millions of dollars and come out with a study that's got, you know, 1,000 footnotes and a bunch of recommendations is just going to give China that much more time to take Taiwan. We need to act now. We know what to do.
There's the point. Thank you for being so clear-eyed about what we need to do. Captain James Fennell, we value so much your appearances at this program and, of course, our work together on the Committee on the Present Danger China. Thank you, and I commend to all of our listeners presentdangerchina.org to see the terrific webinar that Jim Fennell participated in last week. It's really required viewing. Godspeed, my friend. Keep coming back to us with updates on all of this. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton about funding China, among other mistakes we're making, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our regulars here at Securing America, Bill Walton. He is, among other things, a recovering master of the universe from Allied Capital on Wall Street. He is a leader of the conservative movement as the past president of the Council for National Policy, which I'm very proud to be a member. And he is, perhaps most importantly at the moment, the host of a terrific television podcast program entitled The Bill Walton Show. Been privileged to be on it myself from time to time and always delighted to have him here for home dome visits at Securing America. Welcome back, Bill. Good to have you, sir.
Frank, great to be here.
Well, I wanted to start with some research that our mutual friend, Roger Robinson, shared with Maria Bartiromo on her program last week on Fox Business about this thrift savings plan. Bill, you and I have been talking about this for some time, that the federal employees, past and present, military and civilian, have the world's largest public pension fund, some $800 billion. And a fellow by the name of Larry Fink, who we bemoan most weeks of BlackRock fame, has engineered a thrift savings plan mutual fund window that will allow investments to be made up to 25% of the participants' funds in mutual funds. And Roger's research indicates quite a number of them are going to have Chinese companies in them, weighted by 22% in most cases, he estimates. And the implications of this are very significant. I'd like your thoughts on them.
Well, I think this is yet another example of the Chinese working to infiltrate our capital markets and our economy and our and our defense systems with very subtle, systematic, and arcane mechanisms. In this case, they're working the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. There's something called a mutual fund window, which opens up for the thrift savings plan, which allows federal employees to put their savings dollars into these mutual funds. Problem is that about of the 5,000 funds, we really don't know how many companies that are of Chinese headquartered in China or Chinese companies headquartered elsewhere that are in it. And of course, we now know that each and every Chinese company is virtually controlled by the Chinese Communist Party and is part of its four or five warfare strategy, which we've talked about before. And so we're taking U.S. military retiree dollars and putting them into companies who are working assiduously to defeat America.
This is insane, of course, and creates all kinds of, conflicts of interest at a minimum for these government employees.
Well, you know, they're enablers, Frank. We've talked about the enabler, the big enabler is Larry Fink. And then, of course, all the other big investment funds, State Street, Vanguard, what have you. And these companies, A, they don't see anything wrong with the Chinese Communist Party. They're very nice people. They've had dinner with them over the years. But the main thing is they've got a lot of money from them, and they see that big investment market in China, and they want to play in that sandbox. And so to aid and abet the Chinese, they're saying, well, look, we'll make sure the federal government invests its retiree dollars in your companies.
Right. And the thing is that some of these are Chinese companies that are actually involved in sanctioned activities by the U.S. government, whether it's horrible human rights violations, surveillance state operations, genocide, perhaps, slave labor, or worse yet, building weapons with which to kill those very people whose retirement savings are being put into those companies. It's mind-boggling, Bill, and it must be stopped. I hope and pray that what is going to increasingly take place here is that the Congress will be held accountable for allowing this to take place. Indeed, it is some of their money as well. Members of Congress are in the thrift savings plan.
Well, David Jones is the acting chairman of the thrift board, and I would encourage everybody to write a note to Chairman Jones that they're misguided in how they want to steer investment retiree investment dollars.
And let me just say, it's very easy to do that at notsp4ccp.org. That's No Thrift Savings Plan for the Chinese Communist Party, .org. NoTSP4CCP.org. There's an Align Act campaign that allows you very easily to send a note to David Jones and other members of the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, as well as your own elected representatives, saying, don't do this. And I encourage you, as does Bill, to do that. Bill, let me switch gears slightly. Speaking of that surveillance state operation, there is now fresh evidence that the Chinese Communist Party, which has put into place this immense capability, they call it the social credit system, has actually used it to garrote people in China who have been frantic about what's happening to their banks and their funds in those banks. Talk a little bit about how this is working in practice and why it should be of concern to us here as well.
Well, yeah, let's talk about why this matters. I mean, we've got a very obscure story. There are three banks in China, regional banks, but for reasons that are not clear, cut off their depositors' access to their money in the bank. And when the depositors started gathering themselves to protest this and were planning a march on the regional headquarters of these banks, they discovered they couldn't travel. Well, why not? Because in China, you've got your social credit score, your card, and it was basically a health card to begin with. But now, as we see, it's about everything else. And they found their cards, which were just fine, they'd turned from green to red. And what red means is you can't go shopping, you can't travel, you can't basically do anything. You become a non-person. And so they've had hundreds, if not thousands, of Chinese citizens with their cards turned red to protect these banks for reasons which are obscure. And of course, the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, has become pretty opaque in all this. But so but why do we care?
The main thing is it wants to make sure you're not going to do something that they find to be contrary to the
Well, there's all sorts of language they have. When they rolled this out in 2014, there was some language they used. There's glorious behavior and there's deplorable behavior. And glorious, of course, is defined by the party. Deplorable is also defined by the party. So, and that's also opaque. So for reasons which you may not understand, you may find yourself turned into a non-person. Why do we care? We care because the World Economic Forum, at their last meeting in May, I believe, had a big panel, a lot of presentations on how the banks, the credit card companies, the rating agencies have discovered ways that they can incorporate your carbon footprint into their credit decisions. MasterCard now has developed a card that will allow you to allows them or they, whoever they is, to monitor your purchase as to whether or not you're being carbon efficient. And if you get to a certain point where you're not towing the line, they cut off your credit, they cut off your card. This hasn't happened yet, but the reason we're talking about this now is we can't allow it to happen. FICO, the credit rating agency, is also signaling the same thing. They're developing a credit rating system that doesn't just track whether you pay your bills on time or your debt levels or so on and so forth. They're also going to track your carbon footprint. And this is expanding. You know, the carbon is, we've got ESG. Well, carbon is the E part of that, the environmental part of it. But there's also social. And then there's, you know, good governance when it applies to corporations. Well, there's no reason these social credit scores can't apply to a lot of other things, like whether you're a...
Well, and Bill, at the same time, this was going down at the World Economic Forum in Davos, down the road in Geneva. The World Health Organization was touting the emergence of new universal digital health cards, which will play exactly the role that the health passports or health IDs or whatever they call them in China, the social credit score system cards in China play in that particular system. So whether it's T-Mobile's, you know, universal health card or whether it's the carbon footprint tracker or some other digital device, it all gives rise to what we've been calling at the Committee on the Present Danger China, which we're very proud to have you as a member, the digital gulag that is in fact now in prospect in our own country as an application of the China model here. No?
Well, they can't get the Green New Deal passed through Congress. It's too obvious. The headlines are out there, but they can weaponize the banking system to get the same things done. And all the big banks, led by Brian Moynihan at Bank of America, and I think Jamie Dimon as well, have gotten together to say, well, this climate issue is not going to be solved by governments. We need to do this ourselves. And they're talking about committing $150 trillion of basically depositor money to bring about the promised new world that they want.
And among other things, starve companies that they consider to be not green, fossil fuel companies notably, of the capital they need.
It's not just the banks. Walmart just cut off Mike Lindell, My Pillow. They said his pillows didn't meet their new rating criteria without saying what that is.
We're going to have to leave it at that with great regret because this requires further attention, needless to say. Thanks for yours and the great work you do at the Bill Walton Show. Come back to us again next week, if you would, for more here at Securing America. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about thinking about the unthinkable, nuclear war. Our enemies are. Shouldn't we? Straight ahead.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The election of an erstwhile narco-terrorist leader to be Colombia's next president moves Latin America to the brink of being entirely run by this country's enemies. With the fall of Peru and Chile to communists last year and the prospect that Brazil's electorate may soon return to power, its former radical leader, Lula, an enduring ascendancy of indigenous Marxists, seems assured. Worse yet, external forces are at work there as well. The Chinese communists and their Russian and Iranian allies are aggressively expanding influence operations, infrastructure buildouts, and basing arrangements that will strengthen their footholds in the Western Hemisphere under the banner of today's Communist International, known as the Forum of Sao Paulo. No good can come of all this for U.S. commercial or strategic interests, or the flow of still more illegal aliens fleeing leftist predations. Paging President Monroe. This is Frank Effney.
We're back. And when I say back, we're back in a big way because Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is in the house virtually. He is one of America's preeminent authorities on a whole host of national security challenges, but most especially those that involve nuclear weaponry and strategy and capabilities. This is a subject to which he has devoted his life, going back to his days as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and of course, his extended service to our country as a staff member in various positions, including as a professional staff member of the House Armed Services Committee, and also as a member of two different blue ribbon commissions established to evaluate threats from nuclear weapons, including electromagnetic pulse. Dr. Pry is the author of countless articles and a number of books, including Blackout Wars. He is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and always a very valued contributor to this program. Peter, welcome back to Securing America. Good to have you with us, sir. You've been writing a couple of pieces that are so topical that I wanted to spend a minute or two with you dwelling on their significant importance, Peter. One is a piece that you had at Newsmax. It's behind a paywall there, but I understand we can make it available to our audience through the EMP threat website. So give us those coordinates. But it's about a key question. Can a nuclear war be won? And do our enemies think that's the case?
Yeah, the whole article, nuclear war can be won and lost, is at emptaskforce.us. And yes, this article is written in response to the Biden administration's mantra that nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. You know, a statement that was jointly uttered by him and Putin at Geneva. But Putin is demonstrating right now in Ukraine how a nuclear war can be won. The great, late great strategist, I think he was one of the greatest thinkers of the past century, Colonist Gray, argued that ever since the invention of nuclear weapons in 1945, you know, they have affected, just by their mere existence, nuclear weapons affect the mental geography of all war, all diplomacy, and of peace as well. Gray would point, I think, to Ukraine as an example of how, even though the Russians are supposed to be on the ropes and are having great difficulties in the Ukraine war, NATO and the United States are deterred. You know, they are, if Russia achieves a victory in Ukraine or manages to evade humiliation, it will be a nuclear victory for them, achieved by the mere threat, you know, of their nuclear weapons. One has to think of nuclear weapons as a chess game, not a checkers game. You know, think of the role that the queen and the rooks play on the board. You might never actually employ them to take out another piece, but the very fact that those pieces exist on the board has the most profound influences on the way you play the game.
You can put someone in check, in other words, by those pieces being deployed properly, of course. Peter, when you talk about the nuclear warfighting thinking and strategy and capabilities of nuclear armed powers like Russia and China now. It's strategic ally. And the fact that these are countries that are now jointly exercising the capacity to engage in thermonuclear attacks against the United States, discuss the seriousness with which they are pursuing this idea of nuclear war fighting, and some of the other capabilities that we mostly ignore, I think, to our extreme peril in this country, like leadership protection and civil defense and air defense and missile defenses deployed in comprehensive ways by such adversaries.
Unlike the Biden administration, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran know a nuclear war can be won, and they are preparing to fight one. World War II was a nuclear war. The United States won that war, and the nuclear victory in that case looked like the unconditional surrender of Japan and the sparing of a million lives from invading the Japanese home islands. That's really all you need to know. Even an anti-nuclear fanatic would have to admit that a nuclear-armed state is going to be able to win a nuclear war against any country that doesn't have nuclear weapons, which is most of the nations in the world. And Russia and China are preparing not just to achieve nuclear victory against unarmed nuclear powers, but against the United States itself. That's why they have deep underground facilities. Russia invests as much in defense, in civil defense, and active defenses, like the 10,000 anti-ballistic missiles and SAMs that ring their country for intercepting our ICBMs and bombers and cruise missiles, deep underground shelters that are impervious to nuclear attack. And amazingly, in the middle of these nuclear threats that happen daily against us from Russia, Biden is signaling that he really does believe a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought by disarming us. You know, he's defunded the Slicam N, the nuclear cruise missile, which was our best hope to compensate for the 10-to-1 advantage that Russia enjoys in tactical nuclear weapons. They have at least 2,000, some say as many as 8,000 tactical nuclear weapons against 200 tactical nuclear weapons, obsolete gravity bombs, that aren't even really completely controlled by the United States. They're a NATO member state territory. I mean, and they are supposed to be delivered by the host country. The B-83 bomb, gravity bomb, they've decided to discontinue that as the last megaton class nuclear weapon in our arsenal. It was the only one that had any kind of a chance of destroying the deep underground facilities that of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran to put their leadership at risk. The one thing that would deter.
We have to pause at that point, but you're taking us to where I want to go next, which is this sort of disarmament agenda and priesthood that is telling us that actually nuclear war fighting can be prevented best by being completely vulnerable to it, which I believe is as crazy as it has ever been, but certainly today more so than we can stand, that's for sure. We're going to talk about that and much more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, nuclear thinker of the first order, and get his take on this so-called nuclear priesthood of the arms controlling community right after this. We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You've seen him on Mark Levin's program with some regularity, among many other places. He is a tremendously important contributor to, well, what passes for a public policy debate about arguably the single most important national security challenge we face, which is the fact that enemies of this country increasingly have modernized their forces, their nuclear offensive capabilities, and, oh yes, by the way, a whole host of defensive capabilities that strongly suggest they believe nuclear wars can be fought and won decisively, and that they're preparing to do just that. We're being told, though, by so-called nuclear experts in this country that actually none of that matters. The most important thing for the United States to do under these circumstances is to disarm. And Peter, you were talking before the break about some of the decisions the Biden administration has been doing in just that regard. You've written a very powerful piece critiquing these nuclear arms controllers at the Gatestone Institute, Peter, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about sort of your thesis and the dangers of heeding this siren's call that if just we disarm, all will be well.
Right. The title of that article in Gatestone is Nuclear Strategy, the War on Expertise, because that's basically what has been going on in this country almost since the invention of nuclear weapons. There's been a powerful movement on the left, anti-nuclear movement, that argue that nuclear weapons, the invention of nuclear weapons, have changed history. And you can't, and the classical principles of strategy have been rendered obsolete by nuclear weapons, and that nuclear weapons themselves are the biggest danger to humanity. So it doesn't matter, you know, whether you have evil actors in North Korea, China, or Russia, the nuclear weapons themselves are the enemy to humankind. And the United States should set a good example by unilaterally disarming to set a path which then Russia, China, North Korea supposedly will follow. And regardless of all the facts that contradict that theory, and we have the biggest example that we've just come out of, because at the end of the Cold War, you know, the United States did, in effect, unilaterally, because the Russians have been violating the arms control treaties, the United States hasn't modernized its forces in 30 years, hasn't modernized the delivery systems, the nuclear weapons. And while we had a 30-year nuclear deterrence holiday, Russia, China, and North Korea have rushed ahead, modernizing and outracing us. That's how the Russians got that 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. That's why they have nuclear weapons capabilities, third-generation nuclear weapon capabilities that we have no counterparts to. Super EMP weapons, weapons specialized for X-ray and neutron radiation. Even North Korea is ahead of us. They've got a super EMP warhead. And China is about to make an enormous great leap forward, probably by deploying 350 to 400 BF-41 ICBMs, the equivalent of a mobile peacekeeper. Each one of those weapons carries 10 warheads. It's a first strike weapon. And that will give them so that the United States would become the third nuclear power when China deploys the DF-41, which is probably going to happen before 2030, in just a few years. They're going so fast. So, you know, whenever we stop.
Peter, let me just ask you, as you look at all of this, the pieces, if you will, on that chessboard that you spoke of earlier would suggest that this theory that our unilateral restraint will prompt very dramatic course corrections on the part of these adversaries. It has been proven to be as wrong as back when Harold Brown, the Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter, famously quipped that when we build, they build. When we stop building, they continue to build. He was talking at the time about the Soviets, but it's certainly true of the Russians these days. It's certainly true of the Chinese and arguably, as you say, even lesser powers like North Korea and Iran are beavering away at this with no regard at all for our restraint. If anything, perhaps incentivized to be even more aggressive in their modernization plans. Does this all matter, Peter Pry, at the end of the day? You've made the argument in our previous conversation that we're watching the effects of deterrence to our disadvantage and that of others like Ukraine, notably. But would you say more broadly that if this continuing asymmetry between obsolescent American forces on the one hand and very capable and increasingly threatening ones on the part of our adversaries continues, that we will in fact find ourselves in peril?
We find ourselves in peril right now. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a nuclear war that we lost tomorrow. It matters as much as the doom of the West could matter. Had we listened to these same voices during the Cold War, we would have lost the Cold War. And it probably wouldn't have ended peacefully. It probably would have ended with the thermonuclear war and the defeat of the United States. And unfortunately, the Biden administration has taken these voices into its inner councils. They have promoted people from that community, the high priests of academia and the anti-nuclear movements like Union of Concerned Scientists and the Nuclear Threat Initiative and Plowshares. These people are in the kitchen cabinet. The Biden administration is the most anti-nuclear administration, you know, that we've ever had. The Biden compelled the Secretary of Defense, the Department of Defense, to fund a study by the Carnegie Institute to make a case as to why the United States should eliminate unilaterally its ICBMs. That's never been done before by any other president. The ICBMs are probably the most important part of our triad because they're ready 24/7 for an adversary surprise attack. They're really the only thing standing between us and a nuclear surprise attack by our enemies. And the Biden.
Yeah, these are the intercontinental range ballistic missiles. We have a number of them, but they're very aged. And the idea that we would unilaterally disarm them as well is an invitation to disaster. I think there's no getting around it. Peter Pry, thank you for the great work that you do illuminating these issues and calling them to our attention as a matter of the urgency that I think they deserve. We appreciate you so much and look forward to our further visits with you about these subjects and more in the days ahead. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that, and that as you work on these issues with us to protect the country we love, that you will go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.